The Edge of the World Art Studio is proud to present Helen of the Iron Horse, written by Paris Danielle Lee. Artwork by Helen Rachel Lee. Music by Fish Zombie and the Onions. And a special thanks to Spooky the Cat for her contributions, fuzzy as they might be.
Chapter 15. The Girl Who Wasn't. Eurysthe was born in a place so far south it was simply called the South. He was born in a time just south of a brutal war that was also, in a way he could not understand, civil. From the moment he was born, he was defined by the things he was not. The first thing he was not was a girl. He appeared to be, to his mother, and to the midwife who birthed him. From what they could tell of the crying baby, it was a girl. After all, he had the body of a girl. But if they could have held him up to the light, and they could have seen through to his soul, they would have known they were wrong. Their mistake was understandable. And, in time, Eurysthe would forgive them for this mistake, and for the mistake of naming him Luca Bella Perdue. A name his father didn't choose because he wasn't there. As Eurysthe grew older, they tried to teach him needlework, but as soon as they weren't looking, he wouldn't do it. He had no talent for it. They tried to teach him to weave, but again, with no passion for it, he gave it up as quickly as he could. He produced nothing that anyone could use. He had some skill at cooking, but seemed to enjoy playing with the fire more than taking care of dinner, so it was decided he shouldn't go anywhere near the kitchen. His father knew none of these things, because again, he just wasn't there. When Eurysthe was 10 years old, his mother became ill with a toothache, and under the advice of her physician began taking medicine that would often cause her to fall asleep for hours. Once, his family had been rich, but most of the money was now gone. All that remained of the large estate was a mansion, several acres of pecan trees, and land that stretched some distance into the forest and wetlands. So there were no servants left to wake Eurysthe's mother the first time he ran away. He made it to the edge of the pecan grove, where the rows of trees that had been allowed to grow wild for several seasons gave way to the forest beyond. He tried to climb a tree in his dress, but the garment was too restrictive, so he took it off. Now free, he removed his shoes and climbed the tree. He pulled the pecans off the branches and crushed them between each other to eat. There he stayed until just before sunset. Even though his newfound freedom had only been for a few hours, he had been happier than he had ever been before. Every Sunday, his mother would forego taking her medicine so that she could take Eurysthe to church. She would pull him into his room and pick out one of the newer dresses, forcing him to wear it. He would fight and squirm and do everything he could not to have to go. Some days she would insist. Other days she would call him a heathen and a harlot. On the worst days, she would hit him until he finally complied. It was in church that he met Stephen, a boy near his age, who lived nearby and attended church with his parents. Eurysthe liked Stephen. He was cute in a kind of ruffled way. His parents either weren't as wealthy or didn't care as much to hide their status as Eurysthe's. What was more important, at least to Eurysthe, was that he was roughly the same size. So one day, Eurysthe decided to run away for the afternoon. His mother tucked comfortably in her bottle. He ran away to Stephen's house. There, he made a bargain. For some of Stephen's old clothes, Eurysthe would let Stephen watch as he changed into them. He would also give him a silk nightdress and one kiss. Eurysthe agreed, although he didn't quite know what Stephen wanted to do with the nightdress. Now that he had a proper set of clothes, Eurysthe began running away more and more. His father didn't know any of these things, as he was still just not there. What there was of his father's influence was a collection of guns. Eurysthe took up hunting on his days out, beginning with the small animals in the orchard, rabbits and doves. Later, he moved on to wilder game in the forests and the wetlands, foxes and deer, and once, just to see if he could, an alligator. He taught himself to maintain the guns and hide from prey. He learned to cook his game, along with tanning and preserving the hides and fur. So he could travel further and find more game, he began camping out and not returning home for days at a time. He wasn't there when his mother died of the fever. And he wasn't there when his father returned with the soldiers. And he wasn't there when the Civil War began. His father was what they called a commander, a strange rank set between ranks. He was a man in charge of men. He had allowed the army to take the rundown plantation as a recruiting office and stronghold for the area. When he had returned, no one was home. His wife had passed some days before. He looked and searched the house for what he believed to be his daughter. What he found instead was all he needed in order to know where Eurycity had gone. Eurycity had set up a blind in hopes of catching a deer along the trail that had led down to Oak Creek. He heard the telltale crack of the splintering wood and the sound of something walking towards him. He held still, thinking that if they didn't notice him, the deer would pass by and he would have his shot. He did not expect the hand that reached down and grabbed him by the collar. It hauled him up and slapped the gun from him. Suddenly, with a fear he had never felt before, he stared into the face of his father. His father said nothing, scruffing tighter on his clothes that had felt so free before. They cinched around him and held him fast. His father pulled him up and over his shoulder in one motion like a sack of potatoes. Holding his son with one hand, he bent down and picked up the gun with the other. He walked back to the house without a word. As he marched past the other soldiers, everyone cleared space for him. He walked into the house and up to Eurycity's bedroom, throwing him on the bed, slamming and locking the door behind him. The room was a mess. Everything from the closets pulled out. The drawers of his desk had been emptied. The bed had been overturned and then put back again. Everything underneath sprawled out on the floor, and what was there was guns, shot, and powder. There were cleaning tools and carving tools. There were pelts of animal and tanned leathers. There was small notes on paper marking little maps of trails and good hunting grounds. His clothes lay on top of everything. His boy clothes. A small collection Eurycity had known he had hidden deep in the closet, pulled out and laid around the room. Eurycity was terrified. Every secret he had spread out at his feet. His father pulled up a chair and sat across the bed. He waited for Eurycity to sit up and look at him. "I'm sorry," Eurycity cried. "I'm sorry. Please don't get mad, please." "Shut the fuck up. Obviously, you're old enough for me to talk to you straight. Which I appreciate because, goddammit, shit has gone fucking wrong. And there's no sense in pussyfooting about it. You know your mother's dead, right?"
"No. When? How?"
"It doesn't matter. She was a weak woman, and that's the inevitable end of it. What matters is that there's a war, and as a former head of the militia, it is my duty to serve. It is the duty of any capable man to defend his home. That is, unless he's a fucking coward. The question that remains is what to do with you. With your mother dead, you would need to go to a relative, but you have none. You're 14 now, so I could marry you off if anyone would have you. But any husband you would take would have to sign up for the war. So you would end up living with his family, and they would demand a dowry, which I cannot afford. So you would end up being sent to the church, or to some orphanage that will probably run low of funds and food, and they would put you out on the street in a year. You'd be homeless. Your safety is not guaranteed. Neither is mine. I'm expected to fight this war and preserve my home, my family, and my way of life. Whether I believe in what they consider as their ideals is not important. If they don't win, everything I have ever considered mine is lost. But what is left of what I have? This run-down plantation, the family fortune, my wife. No, these things are already gone. The only thing I have left is my daughter, and now I come home to find that that may be questionable." He picked up a pair of knickers, looked at them suspiciously, as Eurycity cried, "I am willing to fight this war. I am not willing to give up the last piece of my life for it. He dropped the pants on the ground and picked up one of the guns. Are you any good with this?
Yes,
Eurysides sniffled.
Can you lie and never let anyone know your secret?
Yes. Then here's what I will do. I will go and get you a uniform and cut your hair. From now on, you will call me Sir, and only ever Sir. You will never call me Father. Also, from now on, your name is Luke. You are not a girl, and you never were. You are a boy, and you are going to enlist immediately. I will put you under my command. You will do as I say on every instance and in every moment. Any disobedience will risk your life and your safety. Do you understand?
Yes.
Yes, sir, his father instructed.
Yes, sir,
Eurysides corrected himself. And at that, the bargain was done. Eurysides and his father had a secret to keep. The uniform his father brought him didn't fit exactly, but he felt it fit perfectly. The buttons were steel, and there was a line down the side of the pant leg that was straight and true. His shoes were shiny and beautiful. He hated the way the dresses they had purchased seemed overly fancy and decorated, but somehow the uniform he loved. It even came with a hat. His father let him pick from his collection a pistol and a musket. Both of them were flintlock. His father cut his hair with a dull pair of scissors, and it hurt. But Eurysides couldn't help but smile through the process. For at least a day, he couldn't help but reach up and touch the short, fuzzy patches left behind. His father escorted him to a man with a large ledger. He pointed to where he wanted Eurysides to sign. He looked up at his father, confused.
"I don't know how to spell it," he whispered.
"Like this." His father took his son's hand with the pen in it and moved it for him, spelling out in big block letters, "Luke." He remembered the first day he had run away, sitting in the pecan trees by himself. Eurysides remembered being so happy, he thought there could be nothing better. He was wrong. The second thing Eurysides was not began to define his life. He was not a team player. He missed the days of hunting on his own, in his forest, on his land. He hated the other people in his unit. They were needlessly cruel, violent, foul, and profane. He learned to fight back, playing, as he thought, the game the way they did. He picked up their profanity and used it against them, to keep them at arm's length. When they became drunk and violent, he hit first, often with a shot to the kidneys or a knee to the groin. His attitude towards them became one of careless indifference, and if they died in battle, he would take their powder and shot first. Then he stole anything else he might want. If anyone ever saw him do this, he just shrugged and said,
"What? They don't fucking need it."
He cultivated an air of confidence and skill he proved in battle. He mimicked his father at first, moving from cover to cover. But later, as his skill increased, he would begin to play with his enemies. He would throw rocks and call out insults. He would trick them into revealing their position or lie to them and say he was surrendering. "This is not a game. Stop playing around," his father would often criticize him after battle. Luke thought he was wrong. It was a game, and his results were unquestionable. Then, after each victory, he was the first to lead the men into what they were really there for: looting. His father commanded a special team. Their job was to ambush Union troops and search them for newer types of weapons coming from factories in the north, specifically, and most importantly, the Winchester repeating rifle, but also revolvers and other cartridge-based weapons that could be reloaded faster than southern muskets and flintlock pistols. They took first what they wanted for themselves, then stashed the rest for Confederate quartermasters further south. Messengers would come and go, giving them intel on where to find Union forces who could be ambushed, returning with messages of weapon stashes hidden throughout the south, left behind by Eurysides' father. It was on one of their first missions that his father killed the man who had carried the single-action army pistol that Eurysides would one day give to Paris. While not in battle, Eurysides taught himself to read using his mother's old Bible. As soon as he could, he turned to the back, to a small family tree depicting his ancestry going back to his great-great-grandparents. He found what used to be his name and crossed it out, writing under it, Luke. He also learned to wrap his chest in bandages he stole from a doctor who had been amputating people's legs after a rather horrific battle. He felt lucky that his chest had never grown to the size he had seen other women's grow. He figured even his chest knew that this was not what should be. And what he thought would once be a problem, keeping the secret, seemed easier with his hostile attitude and his tall, boxy build. Everything was going better than he could have planned. Until one day, the messenger that came from intelligence further south was Stephen. Eurycity recognized him immediately and hid as quickly as he could. He returned to his tent, staying inside, practicing his letters, until the second in command came from the unit to call. "Commander wants to see you," was all he said, and left. Eurycity dressed carefully. He made sure this time the bandages were in place, and he was wearing every piece of his uniform, his hat, his boots, and his coat, even though the weather was warm enough not to, and no one else was. His father and Stephen waited outside by work tables set high so the father could write messages and make battle plans and go through the general to-do of the business of war, without sitting down and standing up all the time. "Boy," Eurycity's father called. He had taken up calling him boy for a while now. He had two reasons for this. One, he was the youngest of all the people in the unit, and two, on some level it reinforced that he was a boy, and not to ask questions about it. Questions like, why doesn't he ever shave? Or, why is his voice so high? "This is Private Wells," Eurycity's father pointed to Stephen. "Take care of his horse and find him a tent for the night. Dismissed." "Come on," Eurycity mumbled, trying to make his voice sound deep and gravelly. As they walked, Stephen strained his neck to get a better look at Eurycity, then finally asked, "Luca?" Stephen stopped and stared at him. Eurycity froze, not knowing what to do next. "You're Luca Bella, aren't you?" "No, I'm not," Eurycity said, hoping he could just bluff his way out of this.
"No, you are. It's me, Stephen. We knew each other as children. You joined the war?"
Stephen would not let it go. Eurycity had to do something before someone noticed the conversation.
"I'm not."
Eurycity punched Stephen in the mouth, then pushed him down and stood over him.
"I don't know you, and you don't know me. Now leave me alone, take care of your own horse, and find your own damn tent. Don't look for me."
Eurycity turned, leaving Stephen in the dust, and went directly to his tent. Out of nervous habit or fear, he began to pack everything he felt was important to him. He didn't feel safe. He knew, like never before, he may not be able to stay. Hour after hour passed, and he waited for someone to come for him. But no one did. He heard the bell call for supper, but he chose not to go. He saw the sun begin to set, and the cool of night came down on the tent. It was going to be okay. Stephen would keep his mouth shut, either because he would never be sure he was right, or he had been scared into keeping his mouth shut. Then, from outside the tent, he heard someone call,
"Luca."
This has been Helen of the Iron Horse, read by Paris Lee. Artwork by me, Helen Lee. All characters within are fictional and bear no intentional resemblance to anyone living or dead, except, I guess, for Helen and Paris. See more of my artwork and Paris's writing at edgeoftheworldart.com. If you would like to comment on the show or ask any question, please email us at helenoftheironhorse@gmail.com. This podcast was made with the love and support of all of our friends at the LA LGBT Center's Trans Lounge. Thank you.